Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Alien Torts and Law of Nations edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 17, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Coypel v. Royal Dutch Petroleum. The case involved the Alien Tort Statute, or ATS, which permits non-U.S. citizens to bring a lawsuit in federal court in order to seek relief of certain violations of international law. This case was first argued February 28, 2012, and considered whether corporations, and not merely individuals, can be held liable in an ATS lawsuit, and whether the issue affects the jurisdiction of the court even to hear the case. On March 5, 2012, however, the Supreme Court put the Coypel case back on the calendar for re-argument and directed the parties to brief an additional question, whether and under what circumstances the ATS allows courts to address violations of the law of nations that occur outside the United States. In an opinion delivered by Chief Justice Roberts, the court held that a presumption against extraterritoriality applies to claims under the Alien Tort Statute, and nothing in the statute rebuts this presumption. Thus, plaintiff petitioners cannot proceed under the Alien Tort Statute in this case. Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito joined the Chief Justice's majority opinion. Justice Kennedy filed a concurring opinion. Justice Alito filed a concurring opinion, which Justice Thomas joined. Justice Breyer filed an opinion concurring in the judgment, which Justices Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined. To discuss the case, we have Eugene Kontorovich, who is a professor at the Northwestern University School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Kontorovich.
The Supreme Court's decision in Coypel versus Royal Dutch Shell was its second encounter with a 220-year-old statute and resulted in the court unanimously imposing very substantial restrictions on what had become a cottage industry of human rights litigation for worldwide violations of international law in federal courts. The case involved the Alien Tort Statute, which was actually a provision of the First Judiciary Act, one of the first laws passed by the first Congress in 1790, which allows aliens to sue for torts in violations of the law of nations. So the plaintiff is going to be a foreigner, an alien, who can sue in U.S. courts for violations of the law of nations. The statute was really ignored for close to 200 years until in the 1980s, it came to be used by human rights groups and plaintiff's lawyers as a tool to litigate human rights disputes around the world. And one of the notable features of these cases, starting with the very first one, Filardiga, for example, was a case involving, plaintiff was a Paraguayan national now living in the United States who was suing another Paraguayan national now living in the United States for conduct that occurred in Paraguay. So the subject of the conduct was Paraguayan, and the plaintiffs were both aliens. And since then, that has become a common feature of these suits, that they use what would be called in international law universal jurisdiction. Sometimes the courts call these foreign cubed cases. That is to say, a foreign plaintiff, a foreign defendant, and the subject matter of the case also is foreign and does not have a U.S. nexus. Universal jurisdiction. Now, universal jurisdiction is quite extraordinary in American courts. It's very, very rare. And indeed, international law only allows it under very limited circumstances. Now, when the court first agreed to hear this case, Coypel, which involves claims by Nigerian nationals, by a Nigerian ethnic minority, against a Dutch company for allegedly facilitating crimes by the Nigerian government, so this is also a foreign cube suit, the question that it wanted to consider that had been decided by the Second Circuit was whether international law extends liability to corporations. Because the Alien Tort Statute is based on international law, the question, does international law recognize corporate liability? American law, of course, does, but in international law, it's actually much less clear. So the Second Circuit had decided that the corporate liability is not allowed, and that's what the court granted certiorari to decide. Once the case was before the court, the justices, during oral arguments, asked a kind of basic question. Why are we involved in this matter at all? It has to do with purely a Nigerian-Dutch dispute. Why is it before American courts? And as a background norm in American law, called the presumption against extraterritoriality, congressional statutes are not generally thought to apply to conduct abroad unless there's some clear expression that they intend to. Now, usually the presumption against extraterritoriality is about foreign conduct that has effects in America. Here, this is even beyond extraterritoriality. The conduct has no effect or directedness at the United States. There's really no American connection whatsoever with the conduct. And that's very unusual for the courts to hear this. What's the argument that they should? So the Supreme Court asked for further briefing. They said, asked for supplemental briefing on the issue of extraterritoriality. And one of the arguments that they showed is that because the statute, the Alien Tort Statute, specifically invokes the law of nations, well, the law of nations does allow for universal jurisdiction. That's consistent with the law of nations in for what's called universal jurisdiction crimes, things like torture and war crimes, which are what most of the causes of action under the Alien Tort Statute allege. So because it invokes the law of nations, well, the law of nations is about things that happen overseas. The law of nations is about the whole world. That's the argument. And the court, quite properly, I believe, rejected this. And the majority opinion by the Chief Justice makes the following point. Yes, it's true that international law can deal with crimes involving the whole world, but it can also deal with crimes involving America. And presumably the first Congress was mostly interested with crimes that involve America. And it would not turn the Alien Tort Statute into a nullity to say that the kind of offenses aliens were supposed to be able to sue for were offenses committed in America. So if a foreigner in America had their rights under international law violated, they would have a federal forum. Why would one think that Congress wanted to allow, say, an ambassador in England, a French ambassador to England, who was beaten up in England, to sue in the United States? Hard to understand why Congress would want such a thing, and there's no particular evidence that that was intended. So it's true international law is broad enough to encompass such suits, but it's not clear that Congress wanted to go to the absolute maximum of international law. So simply invoking the law of nations does not make the presumption against extraterritoriality go away. Rather, we can say the law of nations will provide a cause of action to the extent that the offenses have a territorial connection to the United States. In other words, even when we're enforcing international law, the presumptive priority of Congress is to enforce international law offenses committed in the United States, not to be a world court, a global judge. Now, all nine justices agreed that a case like this, where there's really no connection with America whatsoever, purely foreign conduct, this would not fall within the scope of the Alien Tort Statute. There was some possible borderline cases that remain undecided. Now, a four-justice concurrence by Justice Breyer and joined by the liberal justices, they suggested that, for example, the Alien Tort Statute should be available in cases where the defendant, the person accused of violating international law, is in the United States. So there are these cases where the people violate international law abroad, and then later they wind up living in America. There's an interest America has in not being a refuge for such people, and that the Alien Tort Statute can vindicate that kind of interest. And Falardiga, the first recognition of Alien Tort Statute claims by the Second Circuit, the landmark case of Falardiga was such a case where the torturer had come to reside in America from Paraguay. But it's a little bit hard to understand why the subject matter jurisdiction, why the extent of the cause of action should depend on where the offender subsequently winds up. Usually the existence of jurisdiction, cause of action, depends on the underlying conduct. Whether the offender is in the United States goes to personal jurisdiction. The court needs the offender to be here to perhaps hear the case under notions of personal jurisdiction and due process, but the definition of an offense and the subject matter jurisdiction of the court is usually defined by the conduct. Secondly, it's not clear why the United States has a particular interest in not having people who violate international law abroad come to the United States that needs to be vindicated by the Alien Tort Statute as opposed to other mechanisms. The traditional legal tool for ensuring that one's country does not become a refuge is extradition. And extradition was well known to the framers. They signed extradition treaties. And it's hard to understand why the Alien Tort Statute would be seen as a supplement to extradition. So normally, if you want not to become a refuge, you say, well, send out or kick out people who come here having committed crimes abroad. So another area that remains open is offenses committed by Americans abroad. So these are extraterritorial, but they have a very strong nexus to the United States. And the language of the majority opinion would seem to cover that, because the majority opinion speaks about conduct taking place outside of the United States. But still, one can imagine, and Justice Kennedy might be vaguely sympathetic, in he wrote a very general concurrence saying that he's only deciding the present case. So he might be open to jurisdiction over Americans committing violations of the law of nations abroad, which clearly America has a considerable interest in. Now, all of those are open questions, but rather marginal ones. The person who comes to the United States to take refuge, that's a marginal case because suing them is not so attractive for plaintiffs. They usually don't have money. That's why plaintiffs stopped suing private torturers and turned to corporations that may have in some way aided and abetted governmental misconduct. So there's not much interest in that amongst plaintiffs. And as for Americans who commit offenses abroad, well, they're probably violating lots of other laws which already apply to Americans abroad, and you might not need the law of nations to pursue them. Finally, I would just like to note the extent of the surprise that this case has generated in the breadth of the majority coalition. That is, there is a unanimous opinion. And when questions about the extraterritorial and indeed universal jurisdiction application of COIBOL began to arise, they were generally dismissed by a vast majority of academics as being trivial or conservative inventions. And those conservative inventions have won the unanimous support of the court, which really nobody, including myself, expected, which again shows the extent to which academics and academic theories might be out of sync with the court. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.